Well, good evening, and thank you everybody for coming out today to hear my talk. I'm glad it's stopped raining so that there's somebody here to talk to. I shall be speaking today about a psychological phenomenon that's overlooked in the philosophy literature and appears to receive only minor attention from researchers in psychology. It is, I think, a phenomenon that's commonplace, of practical significance, and of relevance to varied issues in ethics. I will not today be presenting a tightly crafted argument in support of a precise claim, but more of an exploratory survey to make the looser case that the phenomenon in question is worthy of extended theoretical attention. My personal philosophical background can be described positively as eclectic and interdisciplinary, or not so positively as unfocused. I'm drawn to issues concerning mental structures and processes, the pursuit of truth, insight, and understanding, and how this gets corrupted, how we use, make sense of, and are affected by language, virtue, moral and intellectual, and human interaction and moral responsibility. When compelled to provide a single self-identifying category term, I say that my field is moral psychology, which concerns the way that the mind and its processes bear upon moral questions. One more autobiographical datum. I teach students who are obtaining an engineering-heavy education to prepare them to be officers in the United States Navy and Marine Corps. The few philosophers we have on staff there were hired not to make philosophical exploration available to these clever young men and women, alas, as there is a shortage of appreciation in those military services for philosophy, or indeed most of the humanities and social sciences, but rather to teach a required and certainly important second-year course in ethics for military leaders. My topic for today has been somewhat prompted by the Naval Academy's understandable preoccupation with preparing students to cope with the physical, mental, and moral demands of battlefield combat, a very psychologically challenging environment, and also by a more widely shared experience of classroom teaching in an era, in the United States at least, of greatly heightened attentiveness to the sensitivities and sensibilities of students. In what follows, I shall first talk generally about emotionality and its self-regulation, then introduce the phenomenon of interest to us today. Then, after briefly connecting it to the psychological literature on defense mechanisms, I'll use numerous examples to make the case for its broad utility. We will then turn to examining how it works, briefly, contrasting with other techniques of emotional self-management. At this point, we'll examine how taking note of this process can enrich our analysis of moral responsibility in particular cases. Then, following a brief extension of the account from emotions to desires, we will ask whether the technique under examination might be relevant to character virtue, concluding with a sober acknowledgement of the pathological uses to which it could be put. At that point, we'll open up the floor for your comments, suggestions, objections, and questions. Because this is still a new area of research for me, and one where I have not yet settled upon a position or even properly located its philosophical significance, I have even more eagerness than usual to receive feedback from you. I hope that the breadth of my talk will prompt lots of ideas in you for us to discuss. The Q&A period is the generous payoff that I receive for sharing my half-baked ideas with you today, and I'm really looking forward to that. So welcome, those of you who come in. You haven't missed anything except the throat clearing that happened at the beginning of the day. Right, exactly. Emotion inhibition or suppression does not get a lot of good press these days and has not for a long time now. A recent encyclopedia contributor felt no need to provide a citation for the statement that suppression of emotion, especially negative emotion, is typically linked to poor health and well-being for Westerners. Popular Western culture has for decades seen an increase in general valorization of emotionality. The experiencing of emotion is thought to be a basic part of sound human functioning and flourishing. Stunting this endangers relationships, moral behavior, and mental and even physical health. Emotions are informative, helpful, and generally to be acknowledged, valued, and even validated as embodying justified or true perceptions. They emerge naturally in response to events and states of affairs in the environment, just as perceptions do, but they're even more personal and subjective, so their epistemic credentials are not to be scrutinized, let alone challenged. Philosophers, for their part, have extensively explored both emotion generally as well as specific emotions and have presented views that find great value in emotions and emotionality. There's a great deal of truth in these attitudes, I think, and they are a salutary corrective to a long period during which emotions were subject to widespread denigration or dismissal as undeserving of attention. Emotions were regarded as fundamentally counter-rational. They were held to have no place in productive thinking, which was taken to consist solely of the logical manipulation of symbolic propositions. They were associated with women in a partnership that was thought to be mutually unflattering. They were supposed to make no contribution to intelligent action or penetrating inquiry, whether philosophical, scientific, or otherwise. But it is perhaps time for a counter-correction, for the pendulum to swing back toward a more balanced assessment. Emotionality can obviously be informative, productive, gratifying, and fulfilling, but it can, almost as obviously, be disturbing and, more important, counterproductive. Given this, there ought to be a welcome role to be played by methods of emotion self-regulation that counteract the emergence of emotions in certain sorts of circumstances. Such methods could, it would seem, be conducive to better judgment and decision-making and lessening of pointless subjective emotional suffering. Let's consider a simple example. Imagine that tangling for a couple of unpleasant weeks with a flu-like non-COVID illness prompts us to get a physical exam, after which we're summoned for a consultation with the doctor. In his private office, we're presented with the grave news that we have cancer in our blood cells, that is, leukemia. Patients facing a life-threatening illness like leukemia and an aggressive medical treatment like bone marrow transplantation are suddenly confronted with a highly threatening situation that turns their lives upside down. Typically, the time span for adjusting to the new situation is highly compressed. Patients have hardly realized what their diagnosis implies before they are confronted with very aggressive treatments. The mortality rate in bone marrow transplantation is up to 36%. Survival after 1 year is reported to be about 50% when the donor is unrelated and 70 to 80% with a related donor. Yet for most patients, bone marrow transplantation is the very last hope for survival. Now, it's of utmost practical importance for us to be able to discuss intelligently with the doctor what our options are, what actions we ought to take or not take, and so on, and to be able to recall the details of this discussion afterwards. So we cannot afford to become very emotional under these circumstances. Hence, we might attempt to avoid suffering distress by not allowing ourselves to bring to mind, even ideally to the unconscious mind, any cancer-associated imagery that might well cause debilitating panic, or to think of or imagine the more dire of the implications and consequences of our treatment, decline, and possible death. The extra information, the beliefs, images, and speculations would not be relevant to the urgent task at hand. It would not significantly enhance our discussion and planning in the doctor's office. On the other hand, its presence to mind could very well be distracting or crushing in a way that would undermine the current activity. At the very least, it would demand a great effort of will to maintain our composure and focus adequately despite the upwelling of fear, effort that could otherwise be directed in more productive directions. In order to achieve the self-control over our emotional and cognitive responses, therefore, we restrict our engagement with the issues to a purely intellectual plane and a topically constrained one at that, thereby reproducing neither the cognitive aspect of fear nor the affective and physiological aspects that accompany it. Success could seemingly be a matter of degree rather than all or nothing. The managing of our cognitive response will, in fact, also prevent us from experiencing other potent emotions that could derail our rational efforts here. Despair, say, or anger, or grief, because it aims at a broad occurrent blackout of all associated dark, strongly negatively valenced ideas stored within our long-term memory. In other contexts, such as conversations we have about the dire prognosis with our spouse, children, parent, or business partners, it might be that more of the information would be properly admitted within our current perspective to help us plan as well as to connect emotionally to those we care for. Though even here, a good deal of the related memory contents might prudently be suppressed, including much of the potentially attendant imagery. I propose that we use the term shallow cognizing for this method of self-limiting our emotional responses by a selective suppression or non-activation of emotion arousing imagery and verbal thoughts. In describing this process as I have, I do presuppose a cognitivist conception of emotions in which emotions are caused, shaped, and even partly constituted by thoughts, both conscious and unconscious, and both symbolic and imagistic. So I'm using thoughts in a broad sense. If cognitions are components of emotions, then we can readily make sense of our routine observations of emotions being substantially controlled, triggered, moderated, eliminated, redirected, transmuted by the cognitions that are activated and alive within our stream of consciousness and unconsciousness from moment to moment. I say substantially controlled rather than completely controlled because emotions are more than just cognitions. They include physiological elements, for one thing, and they thereby gain an independence that can keep them from being fully under cognitive dominion. Once we have the concept shallow cognizing in hand, it quickly becomes evident just how commonplace it is. Its implementation is not restricted to starkly dramatic episodes like the one we began with. Indeed, that kind of life situation itself will, if things go reasonably well, gradually become more prosaic, and shallow cognizing will continue to have a constructive role to play. As the period of leukemia treatment stretches out further into the future, we hope, the sufferer's family, friends, and associates will do well to avoid having their minds conjure pointlessly disturbing thoughts or images relating to cancer victims, so as not to interfere with their ongoing caring relationships with this sufferer or with one another. The practice of shallow cognizing is not unheard of in common discourse, where it might be termed intellectualizing, often used in a pejorative sense. This usage may have been borrowed and adapted from the domain of psychology, where Freud began a tradition, still alive, of viewing intellectualizing as a defense mechanism unconsciously aimed at allaying anxieties or unacceptable impulses. These mechanisms are respected as normal ways of coping with the vicissitudes of life. More than a century of research demonstrates that defense mechanisms are automatic psychological processes that aid individuals in dealing with internal conflicts and stressful situations, albeit processes that vary in how helpful or dysfunctional they are in supporting human flourishing within particular life contexts. Intellectualization is said, by psychologists specializing in the theoretical formulation and clinical measurement of defense mechanisms, to involve the use of general, impersonal, abstract thinking in order to stave off disturbing feelings. Another closely related defense mechanism, referred to as isolation of affect, is said to keep emotional accompaniments out of consciousness in some unspecified way, but it's not very well distinguished from intellectualization. It's not clear which of these mechanisms might correspond to shallow cognizing. Both mechanisms, at any rate, are yoked together as so-called obsessional defenses in the middle range of adaptiveness of all defense mechanisms. They help the individual in keeping out of awareness parts of the conflict, for instance, associated feelings, desires, and thoughts, which would generate intolerable anxiety if perceived as an integrated psychological experience. By contrast, the mature, most adaptive defense mechanisms or coping strategies promote the integrated and partially aware experience of feelings, ideas, desires, and thoughts associated to an internal conflict or external stressful situation, and help the individual in dealing with his or her psychologically stressful experiences by integrating affects with ideas, therefore optimizing and possibly resolving the internal or external cause of distress. So shallow cognizing seems unlikely to be looked upon with complete favor by researchers in this field. But consider some of the myriad beneficial applications of shallow cognizing. A market investor, say, needs to weigh risks without allowing thoughts of possible catastrophes to render her fearful and irrational in her decision-making. A team of mountain climbers must be able to coordinate their precise actions while avoiding anxious or fearful emotions that could impair execution. Performers, including university lecturers, need to closely monitor their performances, taking note of unplanned problems and handling these without the intrusion of resource-sapping, discombobulating emotions. Poker players, in addition, cannot afford to manifest emotion, which might tip off competitors in ways that can be exploited to their detriment. Those eager to enjoy humor must often be able to resist envisioning the jokingly depicted events vividly, lest revulsion, distress, discomfort, or ethical concern preclude amusement. Shallow cognizing can also be important for interpersonal or intergroup cooperation, a function that is not highlighted in the psychology literature. When people, intimate partners, international diplomats, or anyone in between, need to negotiate conflicting interests, shallow cognizing of the other's expression of needs and requests bypasses thoughts concerning their threatening, anxiety-provoking, defensiveness-eliciting implications, and thereby permits a more patient, sympathetic, slow, cooperative, creative consideration that can discover mutually acceptable resolutions. We also see social and political relations that are dependent upon there being reliable expectations that people can and will exercise shallow cognizing. As when shallow cognizing contributes to productive, respectful, rational discussions of issues that easily arouse tempers or libidos or affronted egos. Relatedly, and we shall return to this later, students receiving trigger warnings from teachers are presumed to possess some capacity for restraining the flaring of emotions that could disturb, distract, or otherwise interfere with rational analysis and discussion. In all these cases, holding emotion-evoking thoughts and imagery cognitively at bay seems a generally effective route to maintaining emotional control. The inhibitory utility of shallow cognizing is not confined to negative emotions. It also helps with emotions that are ordinarily considered to be positive, but that in particular settings can be problematic. For instance, shallow cognizing might prevent a general policy judgment or choice from being unbalanced by a powerful reaction of compassion or empathy to a single person's anecdotal case. Or it can help us control the onset of sexual, romantic, or even merely fraternal feelings of affection in a professional or otherwise unsuitable setting where they might lead to behavior that amounts to sexual harassment or worse. Given the potent behavioral consequences of positive as well as negative emotions, emotional self-regulation is crucial across the board to avoiding infringing upon the rights and interests of others. Not that shallow cognizing is all powerful. Some stimuli to deep cognizing seem to be less resistible than others, such as the smell of a lost loved one versus the sight or verbal description of him or her, or a lengthy or repeated vision of a gruesome wound, as opposed to a quick glimpse or a depiction in words, or repetitive exposure to the serious stressors of a battlefield engagement. There's certainly much to explore concerning the variables that determine the varying degrees of success met by shallow cognizers. Now, I've been speaking as if shallow cognizing is the only emotion self-management game in town, but certainly is not. Recent psychological literature describes, for instance, emotion regulation strategies that include what's called attentional deployment, which is shifting one's attentional focus toward less distressing or more positive emotion-inducing stimuli, cognitive change, modifying one's thoughts to improve mood, and response modulation, which is directly altering the physical or behavioral aspects of an emotional response. According to this model, a person facing an unpleasant work environment might intentionally ignore problematic coworkers, which would be attentional deployment, reframe a boss's criticism as feedback that will help a career trajectory in the long term, it's a cognitive change, or practice relaxation and deep breathing techniques to facilitate relaxation when becoming annoyed by coworkers, which is a response modulation. This provides a landscape in which to situate shallow cognizing. Notice how shallow cognizing differs from the methods that redirect our attention toward different perceptions or thoughts that will undermine or counteract the arousal of an undesired or unhelpful emotion. Shallow cognizing arguably holds the advantage over these techniques as it permits continued cognitive engagement with the ideas or realities needing to be faced without either escaping into self-distraction or diverting into a very different construal of the situation. When we need to deal intelligently and promptly with a diagnosis of leukemia, it's no help to start thinking about politics or football, except to offer a brief breather before returning to reality, perhaps, or even to find silver linings, though such perspective shifts certainly have their place and can be profoundly valuable. Likewise, those who are determined not merely to fret about aspects of themselves, their lives, and their worlds, but to work to change those, cannot simply switch the channel to something that's completely different or has been reconstrued to be emotionally benign. If they're to strive to make improvements in the realities that disturb them so, they need to engage mentally with those realities, but without being brought low emotionally by them. Someone who finds herself overwhelmingly dismayed and despairing when mulling over the plights of the poor or of animals in the modern world must, if she's to play the role of activist, find some way to engage mentally with the issues that so disturb her, to read and listen and view and converse and write about these issues, all the while decoupling the foreseeable emotional reactions whose strain may undermine her ability to continue and even her physical and mental health. Shallow cognizing does not, of course, eliminate the threats or doctor's dire reports. It does not itself undo harsh realities, but it does facilitate our coping with them intelligently. And its function is often to postpone an emotional reaction, not to eliminate it permanently. The ideal outcome might typically not be complete prevention of an emotion, but mere delay until the circumstances are more propitious for confronting them. Moreover, most emotionality is benign and stands outside of shallow cognizing's proper sphere of action, which embraces only emotions that interfere with proper functioning. So a position in support of the use of shallow cognizing does not entail a general stance against emotionality. It can deem emotionality highly valuable and important as long as it's in its proper place, with shallow cognizing being a tool for situating it where it will best serve the good. How exactly then does shallow cognizing work? What's the mental mechanism that underlies it? I've said a tiny bit about it, and I'll say a little more. And what I say will be speculative and without a strong argument. But I do invite your comments on the account I give. My starting point here, and indeed in much of my research elsewhere, is that the individual cognitive system is not fully integrated. Numerous familiar psychological phenomena, including priming effects, framing and schema and script effects, expectation effects, temporary forgetting, inconsistencies among beliefs or belief-like states, setting relative personas that we adopt, and ambivalence, suggest that our cognitive endowment, the pool of resources stored in memory for utilization and thinking, resources that I take to comprise both sentences and images, is not a single fund from which any and all assets are available to be activated whenever relevant to the current topic of cognition. Rather than providing such fashion a single perspective upon the world, our endowment is functionally compartmentalized in a complex pattern that actually supports many distinct, partial, partly overlapping, situation-triggered, and sometimes mutually inconsistent perspects. What's that called? Our stream of cognizing, which is only partly conscious, involves a continual shifting from one perspect to another, as differing subsets of our representational resources get activated for the pragmatic task at hand as we perceive it. In short, our standpoint keeps changing. How we think or behave in one kind of setting is no sure indicator of how we think or behave in a different one. Shallow cognizing, then, seems to work by creating a perspect that is insulated or sealed off from certain kinds of memory representations. We manage to activate the focal ideas with which we need to reason, for example, in planning how to respond to our leukemia diagnosis, but we leave unactivated some representations that, by virtue of their associations and relations with the focal ideas, would ordinarily be activated as well, but for the shallow cognizing. Engaging in shallow cognizing can be analogized to using a simulated computer, also known as an emulator or a virtual machine, as a safe sandbox environment, as they're called, in which to examine potentially dangerous entities without exposing the rest of the system to risk of infection. So just how available is this shallow cognizing to ordinary people? Is this a capacity that all possess or that can at least be developed by anyone? Or does it require some specialized kind of mental training and practice? Does practice in shallow cognizing strengthen one's ability in a way that transfers readily across different sorts of emotional listening stimuli, such that maybe practicing in educational settings when confronted by emotion-triggering ideas can empower one to better handle not only future classroom provocations, but emotional triggers elsewhere in life? It's important that we find answers to these empirical questions because they bear upon significant issues of moral right and wrong. Shallow cognizing is relevant not only to achieving our practical ends, as I suggested earlier, but also to the moral relationships that we bear to one another. The earlier examples I offered were cast in terms of the self-interest of the shallow cognizer. But of course, there were possible moral dimensions to those scenarios too. The mountain climbers, for instance, may owe it to their loved ones to take all reasonable measures not to be undone by panic on the rock face. The market investor and poker player may have dependents counting on them to avoid emotion-caused poor performance. But a pure case of moral responsibility to others, a simple one, is presented by the choral singer, who is at risk to choke up, literally, when singing a certain moving passage of text. And I know where I speak about that. He needs to remember that singers indulging their emotional inclinations are likely to undermine the audience's ability to satisfyingly indulge theirs. But he can meet his ethical obligation here by using shallow cognizing while still clearly enunciating the words he sings and understanding their meaning. Another interesting sort of case is presented by the negative reactions of some passersby to women who are nursing young children in public. Policy discussions commonly balance the rights to breastfeed and to be breastfed against the supposed rights of these bystanders not to be compelled to experience discomfort, revulsion, or other aversive emotions. A first response to the bystander's claim might be that they can look away if the sight is disturbing to them. But this fails to grapple with the apparent psychological reality that much of the breastfeeding-related emotional suffering derives not from being confronted by the actual sight of a woman's breast, but by unseen thoughts and images that onlookers allow themselves to activate when witnessing nursing, even when there's no breast or suckling that's visible at all. Now, if the passersby can be expected to engage easily in shallow cognizing, then their complaints seem to have no purchase whatsoever. That is, as it is then their own failures to deploy this self-regulation measure that is the morally relevant cause of their own suffering. Might such an analysis be condemned as victim blaming? That wouldn't be surprising, though in my view, victim blaming charges do not cut the ice they're popularly thought to cut, but that's a topic for another time. A still richer example might be found in the realm of informed consent to medical procedures. Our earlier leukemia example suggests that shallow cognizing may play a highly constructive role in patients' provision of consent, as it makes it possible for them to weigh their options and choices without having to fight off their own distressing, disorienting, and deflating emotional reactions. If doctors can be confident that patients who face serious health challenges are capable of calmly and rationally processing all the decision-relevant information regarding those challenges and the medical and non-medical interventions that are available, then they can open the information spigot, or tap, and patients will be able to make fully informed choices without feeling overwhelmed or wrenched in certain directions by painful emotions they're undergoing. On the other hand, what if patients cannot be counted on to mobilize shallow cognizing effectively wherever it's needed? Then doctors will be tempted, perhaps rightly, to withhold choice-relevant information that's emotionally highly disturbing and therefore thereby liable to exert an irrational bias upon the patient's choice. In the jargon of the law courts, the probative epistemic value of some information would be outweighed by its likely prejudicial effect. In which case, we might encounter episodes like the one I experienced with my own orthopedist as he and I planned an arthroscopic surgical procedure on the meniscus of my knee. He said nothing to me at that time about the procedure involving tourniquets and the wrenching or distorting of my knee joint in order to fixture it in place for the surgery, or the resulting micro-tearing to be expected in the anterior cruciate ligament and the discomfort this would produce post-op. I learned about these standard features of the procedure only after the surgery, from the notes taken during the procedure, plus what the doctor's assistant said at my first post-op follow-up appointment. Given my seeming shallow cognizing capability, it looks as if I was wrongly denied the opportunity to give informed consent to the procedure, unless at least, the doctor had good reason to expect that I, perhaps like most of his patients, or most surgery patients, or most medical patients, couldn't handle the truth, as Jack Nicholson said in A Few Good Men. That is, that I would not possess the mental resources to make good, rational use of the extra information. So it is important that we ascertain just how competent people in all walks of life are at shallow cognizing. And it's also important that we learn whether shallow cognizing is a skill that can be developed, and if so, how. For it is an empowering skill, and when we are known to possess it, it heightens the respect with which we must be treated by others. They're not permitted to paternalistically withhold from us information to which we are otherwise entitled on grounds that it will disconcert us, arousing emotions that will overwhelm our capacities for rational decision-making. Another setting in which moral issues arise, with greater complexity but still serious personal and political consequences, is education, where, in the USA at least, there are frequent allegations made by students of having been harmed and victimized by upsetting, insulting, or offending words or images. Such charges are taken very seriously by school administrators, especially when the students have issued their complaints on social media or other public fora, and they often result in serious punitive consequences for the instructors involved. Many university faculty approve of this state of affairs. Many decry it. Might shallow cognizing have some relevance to the controversy? Well, if shallow cognizing is a practice that students routinely can practice competently at low cost, then it would seem to deflate the students' claims of harm. If psychic vulnerability to potentially disturbing content such as mere mentions, not uses, of supposedly toxic slurs, or microaggressions like a statement praising colorblind merit standards, or tentative statements of controversial or widely despised political or social views, their psychic vulnerability to such material is largely under recipients' control through the shallow cognizing technique of mental self-management, then this removes a substantial part of the case to suppress or punish the expression of such content. There may remain reasons to limit or prohibit the expression, but they will not concern its infliction of psychic pain or damage. By promoting, and teaching as necessary, the use of shallow cognizing, educators would be free to pursue and model basically unfettered inquiry in the educational environment, including about difficult topics like sex, violence, death, religion, and race, while not provoking emotional reactions in sensitive students that could undermine their learning. Indeed, it could well be that classroom experience in handling disconcerting emotional reactions is itself educational, that it helps students develop their shallow cognizing capacities, thereby providing an important component of the emotional hardiness and resilience that students will need in their subsequent professional intellectual activities if they're not to veer off course whenever encountering matters that threaten to disorient, disturb, and discompose them. We cannot take a settled stance on this topic, however, until we know the empirical realities regarding shallow cognizing. And those realities might well complicate the final picture. It could turn out, for instance, that while shallow cognizing is effective and widely available for deflecting the majority of slings and arrows, certain kinds of traumatic experience produce emotional reactivity that cannot be easily overcome by the shallow cognizing mechanism. Additionally, does shallow cognizing consume resources of which we have a limited supply, such that we have to be aware of inflicting shallow cognizing fatigue upon our students, whereupon they find its exercise more taxing or even ineffective? It will also be worth learning whether an inability to utilize shallow cognizing effectively is fostered or reduced by certain experiences or attitudes, for instance, about oneself and one's psychic vulnerability, or about others' emotional conditions and experiences, or about the nature of emotions. Empirical data will not resolve all the conceptual and ethical issues, of course. Suppose that we learn that students are able to cognize shallowly about blatantly disturbing content. Like profanity or bigoted speech or blunt descriptions of disgusting situations or violent atrocities. But that later, they often encounter memories of the initial prompts, and that these memories are not as reliably and effectively stripped of their aversive emotion by shallow cognizing at those later moments. Or subsequent protective shallow cognizing is just as effective in most instances, except that some of the recognized episodes occur when the recipient is not well positioned to conduct shallow cognizing effectively, such as during a sleepy state or an illness or an emotionally vulnerable period. If these are the realities, then we'll need to grapple anew with how to balance the cognitive and emotional burdens borne by students against the benefits of making classrooms venues for open, unblinkered, fearless inquiry rather than safe spaces where social taboos are not challenged or ignored, but deferentially honored. And how do trigger warnings intersect with shallow cognizing? Suppose that our cancer diagnosing doctor character had prefaced his terrible report of leukemia with a trigger warning about how he had some terrible news to impart. Would that have made it easier for the patient to get his shallow cognizing going? We might reasonably expect that a trigger warning will help people, including students, to initiate their shallow cognizing mechanisms. But the research, which I've only begun to explore, is seemingly tending not to support this, suggesting instead that expressed trigger warnings have little effect, and in trauma survivors actually themselves trigger a heightened anxiety over what is to come, an anticipatory anxiety, and reinforce survivors' views of their trauma as central to their identity, in these ways perhaps undermining the engagement of the shallow cognizing mechanism. While the discussion thus far is focused upon shallow cognizing as a tool for controlling emotion, it may actually be of broader utility. The shallow cognizing process, the call, is but a means to override the normal situation or task-based activation of representational resources from our compartmentalized cognitive storehouse. While altering the sets of cognitive assets, both sentential and imagistic, that are activated for use can obviously shape emotions, given the dependence of emotions upon cognitions, something parallel, I think, can be said for desires. Desires, too, are shaped by cognitions. So shallow cognizing should offer control over these as well, to some degree. consider a couple of brief examples. If we are giving intimate counsel to a friend for whom we might have romantic or sexual feelings, we might engage shallow cognizing in order to block activation of fantasy images and thoughts that would only breed disruptive desires. Or, depending upon the matter under discussion, we might need to interrupt the unhelpful arousing of longings, possibly envious for what our friend is contemplating, like exotic travel or quitting his job. We might temper our desire to lash out punitively at an insult or an instance of sexual harassment by inhibiting activation of thoughts about the negative event's adverse implications for us, for our vulnerability to future follow-on misconduct, our reputation, our relationships, and what will be felt by our loved ones when they hear about what we've suffered, as well as by inhibiting activation of imagery related to such implications, such as our furious or crestfallen spouse, or to the event itself, like the perpetrator's smirking face. I will close my remarks today by considering whether, given what we've surveyed so far, the capacity and inclination for shallow cognizing might be components of character virtue. Do they not facilitate apt responses, emotional, desiderative, behavioral, and intellectual, to circumstances that might otherwise throw us off kilter by arousing unhelpful emotions or desires? If we can, for instance, think clearly and forthrightly about the dangerous circumstances we face, yet with the aid of shallow cognizing, stem the arousal of fear, we should be better positioned to face these circumstances courageously. We will, however, need to choose wisely when to deploy shallow cognizing, as it's a tool that can be used to prod ourselves toward, in this case, fear-ignoring action, whether the action would be virtuous or vicious. So there would seem to be no escaping the need for Aristotelian practical wisdom in being able to discriminate the virtuous from the vicious courses in concrete situations. Only now it needs to guide also the deployment of the instrument of shallow cognizing. Ordinary discourse, we should note, sometimes includes character attributions and evaluations that arguably turn upon the use or non-use of shallow cognizing. A political leader who cannot talk about potentially emotional issues like environmental catastrophe without getting visibly choked up and apparently losing some control is liable to be judged harshly by the electorate as unfit to lead on account of a character flaw of oversensitivity. The norms are complex and shifting, as the same politician might be faulted for insensitivity were she or he to employ shallow cognizing to provide entirely detached comments on a child-centered threat or tragedy. We seem to recognize that people are endowed with some powers to regulate their emotions, and our perception of these powers seems to bring with it the ascription of moral responsibility for the emotional responses that we do permit ourselves. Now, four challenges might be lodged against the proposal that shallow cognizing plays a role in virtues of character. First, it might be thought that surely virtue, which comprises rationality, ought not require avoidance of certain thoughts or knowledge. Judgment and decision-making cannot benefit from contracting the cognitive base upon which they rely, we might suppose. But an information avoidance requirement is readily acceptable once we allow for a broad notion of rationality whose standard is not purely epistemic, but also practical. When the human ideal is understood, as in the Aristotelian tradition, to include apt behavior, motives, emotions and emotional reactions, choices, values, desires, perceptions, attitudes, interests, expectations, and sensibilities, then the virtue ideal can no longer presuppose maximal knowledge, for there are trade-offs between knowledge and some of these other desiderata. For instance, recall the early example of an arousal of excessive empathy or compassion. Here, using shallow cognizing to constrict the information we entertain might undermine this arousal, thereby averting an unbalanced judgment or choice that would have been responsive only to a subset of the multiple relevant considerations while being neglectful of others. The second challenge to shallow cognizing as a contributor to virtue derives from the fact that shallow cognizing is not itself a distinct dimension of character akin to generosity, good temper, patience, or courage, but a psychological faculty or activity that cuts across numerous such dimensions. In this, it seems perhaps similar to continence or willpower or self-discipline. But willpower is an asset deployed by the non or not yet virtuous when faced with uncooperative, contrary to reason, desires and emotions. So maybe shallow cognizing is, likewise, not a component of virtue, but a compensatory resource used by those lacking in full virtue. However, there are important functional differences between continence and shallow cognizing. The ideally virtuous person could not dispense with shallow cognizing in the way she could dispense with willpower if her other psychological dispositions were operating fully rationally. Even if she were competent in utilizing attentional deployment, cognitive change, and response modulation to achieve emotional self-regulation. Such approaches would be less effective than shallow cognizing and could not substitute effectively for it. For one thing, those other practices of self-regulation standardly engage only after troubling emotional arousal has begun, leaving an inertial residue still to subside, whereas shallow cognizing is typically deployed in advance or at the very outset of arousal. For another, shallow cognizing has the advantage when it comes to managing desires, at least in the domain of responding to verbal stimuli. If someone tries to tempt us with dessert or sex by graphically describing his delights, we can utilize cognitive change by reminding ourselves of our reasons not to indulge, but akrasia or incontinence may well undo us. On the other hand, if we can cognize the verbal descriptions shallowly, the resulting detachment should stand us a better chance of resisting the temptation. Moreover, and more significant, other techniques of emotional self-regulation achieve their emotion and desire thwarting or undermining effects only at high cost, by subverting our ability to engage mentally with the eliciting stimuli, and thus our ability to remain intellectually engaged at length in rational discourse. We don't want to be rudely uncommunicative with the person who wishes us the pleasure of a wonderful dessert or sexual encounter, and we can't participate competently in a discussion of our dire medical situation if we're repeatedly distracting ourselves or, say, rehearsing reassuring thoughts. Shallow cognizing avoids such costs as it permits more selective content restrictions upon a current cognizing. A third objection to linking virtue to shallow cognizing is an over-intellectualization critique. Shallow cognizing may seem to reduce human thinking to mere abstract symbol processing by eliminating, or more accurately, not activating the associated representational resources, especially images, that are most prone to arouse emotions and desires. But this seems to me a distorting exaggeration. Shallow cognizing need not interfere, say, with being highly creative, witty, or amused in handling verbal information. It permits, and in some cases facilitates, friendly, affectionate, and loving feelings. In fact, it's very selective in its suppression of emotion and desire. Through its cognition activation inhibition, it targets certain mental states for avoidance while allowing others to be aroused freely. For instance, we might utilize shallow cognizing when talking about a painful life episode or a perilous situation we now face, while in the same conversation becoming indignant upon learning how some people are being mistreated or pitying toward the student in our office who tells us of his family tragedy. There's one more challenge to a tight linkage between virtue and shallow cognizing. Up to this point, we've been surveying shallow cognizing's admirable power, appreciating the benefits it provides. But does it have a darker side? Indeed, it can be used in ways that do not promote human flourishing. Nothing in the foregoing discussion, I hope it's clear, entails that all exercises of shallow cognizing tend toward the virtuous. While maintaining clinical intellectual distance has broad utility, it can be directed not only against irrational emotions and desires, but also rational, appropriate ones. It can distract us from irrelevant, prejudicial, or competence-compromising information, but also from considerations that do deserve our attention. For instance, it can spare us from having to face death head-on, which might be sensible if we're currently not in a position to do that productively, or might be cowardly, evasive, or in bad faith. There's no prima facie reason to believe that shallow cognizing cannot be initiated as part of a program of motivated irrationality. Or consider how shallow cognizing can interfere with rational decision-making if its filtering out of information ends up subverting a key part of the process of decision-making, our imaginative awareness and evaluation of alternative scenarios and options. In cases like these, we can speak of pathological, dysfunctional, or vicious shallow cognizing. There may also be cause to worry that shallow cognizing can, for some people, become a mechanism of habitual emotional withdrawal and deadening. We might expect, for instance, that those whose normal emotional reactions have been consistently penalized or ignored may become fixed in a pattern of shallow cognizing, suppressing even emotions that would be productive. And shallow cognizing can certainly convey false or misleading signals to others about our beliefs and other attitudes, as well as our emotional and other psychological traits. For instance, when it serves to inhibit our manifestation of emotion or desire, it can easily cause others to mistakenly take us to be not caring, or as being generally detached and unfeeling. But this danger would abate somewhat would explicit awareness of shallow cognizing become widespread. Finally, in ethical judgment and decision-making, we would hope that shallow cognizing would work to suppress the arousal of emotions and desires that tempt us away from morally sound judgments, such as a lawyer finding it hard to defend his repulsive client or a submarine weapons officer balking at firing his missile, but it might at times counter-ethically block emotions that would inform us more fully of reasons or stakes that we're not confronting frankly. Like the Nazis, who would recoil viscerally from their brutal conduct and experience terrible guilt, if not for deploying psychological techniques to suppress these enlightened reactions. I hope I've thrown out enough provocations to stimulate your creative and critical faculties and that you will not hesitate to share your thoughts and experiences now. Thank you very much for your attention.